I think we should probably start, so I'm going to alert the media that it's about time to start the recording. We're going to try to record this, even though almost all of my lectures has to deal with slides, but we're going to see if we can work it out and if it's worthwhile. I'm Larry Collins. I'm a geologist here in the village and been up here several summers answering questions about rocks, and there are two of us here. But I've been facing the problem of creationism with the people who are so-called creation scientists for more than 30 years. These people consider me as a geologist and a scientist to be totally atheistic. That is, I'm sure I've got the devil in me, that there's no hope for me. And to counter that, I need to tell you that I know that to be a Christian, coming to Holden Village doesn't make you a Christian any more than going into a church makes you a Christian any more. If you climb into a chicken coop, makes you a chicken. And I just want to tell you that I've committed my life as a personal, I want to follow Christ, and I've made that kind of commitment. And on that basis, I'm going to show you things that maybe you haven't looked at before. And in order for the recorder to get here, I'm going to read this, although most of you have read it already. That is, creationists try to use science to prove that the Bible is inerrant. Young Earth creationists believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible without any scientific error, and that the Earth was created less than 7,000 years ago, and that's less than 5,000 BC. According to a Gallup poll, more than 47% of Americans have this belief, and 10% of the colleges teach it. So I know it's out there. Perhaps there are many of you who feel the same. This talk is going to divide up into four parts. Please hold your questions and comments until later, because I have a lot to cover, and I want to have your full attention all the time. First of all, we're going to talk about the three different polonium halos as false indicators of instant creation. Secondly, we're going to look at the great age of chlorine ions in the world oceans. Third, we're going to look at a bogus Noah's Ark site in Turkey. And four, I'm going to suggest that the Bible in some places is a false guide to some kinds of medical science. Now, in the early or late 1980s, there was a man named Robert Gentry who was a physicist, and he wrote a book, Creation's Tiny Mystery. And in this book, he said he had scientific evidence to indicate that there was instant creation of the earth by fiat, by act of God, on the third day of Genesis 1. Now, this is a picture of a thin section of granite, and right here is a biotite mica flake. In that biotite mica flake, there are little tiny crystals of zircon, and inside the zircon are uranium atoms, which are radioactive. They're shooting out alpha particles like cannonballs out into the lattice of the biotite mica, and they're damaging it to create uranium rings. There are actually four different rings that are created in this process. You can't see the rings here in this thin section because I normally work with a thin section that's 300 millimeters thick. And in order to see it, you look, well, 300 millimeters is about a quarter of the thickness of a sheet of paper in a book. In order to see the rings, you have to grind it down to 100 millimeters thick in order to do it. So you're really, one more swipe and you've lost it. Okay, next. Now here's what these rings look like. There are eight different rings for uranium, and starting with U-238, and you go down with isotopes down here with all eight of them. One down here is radon-222, and the last three that are present in the radioactive decay series are polonium-218, polonium-214, and polonium-210. This man has found places where you find only the three rings here present, the two rings present, or one ring present, and you don't find any evidence of uranium or anything that is a precursor for it. Now, what is the significance of this? Next. Okay, we need to understand uranium decay series. And I know most of you are not scientists, so I'm going to try to explain this. And whatever, what you start with uranium-238, which is an isotope of uranium. It's a kind of uranium whose half-life is 4.5 billion years. Now, what do I mean by that? It is whatever amount that you start with, in 4.5 billion years, half of it's gone. In the next 4.5 billion years, half of that's gone, so you have a quarter left. The next 4.5 billion years, half of that's gone, so you have an eighth of it left. Are you with me? All right. So each of these send out alpha particles. An alpha particle has a mass of 4. So as you come down here, you're kicking out something with a mass of 4. So the number drops by 4 as you go down the sequence. So each of these drops by 4. And I want to call your attention to the fact that radon here has a half-life of 3.82 days. And the polonium isotopes have exceedingly short half-lives. Polonium-218 is about 3 minutes. Polonium-214 is microseconds. And polonium-210 is 138 days. And finally, you get down here to the last isotope, and it's no longer radioactive and it's stable. And from that point, nothing more happens. Okay, this is Gentry's model for why the Earth is young. What he says, if you start with the polonium-218, 214, and 210 halos where they're formed, and they're formed independently of any uranium present in the rock, and because they have extremely short half-lives of 3 minutes, 200 microseconds, and 138 days, and if you need at least 10 billion of these atoms there in order for you to see a visible halo, that takes a lot of them before you can actually see it. And the reason is that this happens instantaneously. That is, it takes granite about 5 million years, a large body of it, to cool down to the point where you can grow a biotite crystal. So regardless of how much polonium that you start with, if you have to wait 5 billion years to get before you can start to grow these things, their short half-lives are so short, there won't be anything left to make the polonium halos. So on that basis, what Gentry says, granite must form instantaneously on day 3 of the Genesis week. You follow me? It makes absolutely good sense, and it's very logical. But is there another way to explain how these polonium halos form? Now, this is a thin section of granite. This area that's light gray with the lines through it is a plagioclase feldspar. And the gray gingham crosshatch material is potassium feldspar. I find in my geological research that in some places you start with a rock which is microfractured, and potassium comes into the rock and changes the plagioclase feldspar, which has calcium and sodium in it, into potassium feldspar. You must have potassium feldspar before you can have granite. So it's a chemical replacement process at temperatures below the melting condition, not when melts form. We're not cooling down from melt. We're starting with something that's solid, and we're fracturing it and bringing in potassium to change it into granite at temperatures below melting conditions. Are you with me? Okay, this is another thin section of granite, and this area right here is also potassium feldspar. I'm telling you, at one time, there used to be plagioclase feldspar here, and potassium came in here and changed that plagioclase feldspar into potassium feldspar, and this is an area where the replacement was incomplete. It forms a texture that's called myrmecite. And I find that wherever this happens, I find myrmecite as evidence that it happens. It's one of the clues that it happens. Now here's a piece of biotite mica. Right across here is a fracture, and you can see the damage done by radon gas, which is inert. It doesn't react with anything. People get it in their basements. In some parts of the United States, it's radioactive. You have to be aware of it because you got to flush it out so you don't get radon gas into your lungs. But nevertheless, it's decaying to form polonium. And here's a place where polonium in this biotite mica has crystallized, precipitating the polonium, and that is a polonium-210 halo there. So here's the evidence that you've got a microfracture through the biotite. And there's where the radon is moving through. It doesn't react with anything. It produces polonium, which is reactive, and it crystallizes in the biotite. All right. So now we move to an area in Bancroft, Ontario. Here's the city of Bancroft. There are three uranium mines in this area, the Fission Mine, the Silver Crater, and the Faraday Mine. This is granite in here. All of these mines are associated with calcite veins, which are not granite. Calcite veins can only be formed at temperatures below melting conditions where the system is completely open, so fluids can come in and deposit the calcite. The uranium in here, there's a beta-tite, which is uranium ore. That beta-tite is right in that zone. It's decaying and producing all of the radioactive decay series at radon-222, so there is an immediate source of radon to produce these three different types of polonium halos that you can see right here. Not only that, I find myrmecite all the way through this granite. This rock is highly deformed and broken. That pink stuff that's now granite used to be a purple rock, which had plagioclase in it and no potassium feldspar. So you have an immediate source of uranium right there adjacent to where these polonium halos are formed, and the rock is being formed at temperatures below melting conditions. This can happen if you next slide. So polonium halos are found only in myrmecite-bearing rocks, where you have a nearby uranium source, and there's no polonium halos found in any granite where you find the rocks have originated from a melt. So because the rock systems are kept open by repeated deformation, the polonium halos then do not form instantaneously. They are formed over thousands of years as fracturing occurs, and so fluids can come in and grow these particular polonium halos. All right, next topic. One of the ideas for the origin of how old the Earth was to take the amount of sodium chloride that's washed into the oceans. The streams bring a certain amount of salt in the oceans, and this is in the form of dissolved sodium and chlorine. And so they measured the amount of sodium coming in from the streams, and they asked themselves, how long would it take before the oceans are as salty as they are from sodium chloride coming into the oceans? Okay. They calculated that it would take about 100 million years. Then they began to realize that as fast as the sodium is coming in, it was being precipitated by the clay in the oceans, and so you reached equilibrium, and you never got anything older than 100 million years because the sodium was being subtracted out of the system. So they knew at least the oceans were as much as 100 million years old, but they didn't know how much older it was. They no longer could use sodium. A creationist contacted me by email, and he pointed out to me, if all the dissolved salts in the world oceans were put back onto the continents and precipitated there, the average thickness of all these salts put back on the continents would be 500 meters. And then he pointed out to me, well, the continents are only 1,800 meters thick. How in the world can you get 500 meters of salt out of 1,800 meters? Doesn't make any sense. And I agreed with him. It's impossible to get that out. Well, where did this sodium chloride came from? Well, I thought it would be relatively easy to find out. It didn't come from the continental material. It must have come from the Precambrian rocks underneath the continents, which were eroded down to release the chlorine. And this is the way it occurred. So I decided to look into it. If you take the eight most abundant elements in the Earth's crust, there are oxygen, silicon, aluminum, iron, calcium, sodium, potassium, and magnesium. Oxygen is the most abundant. In parts per million, there are 466,000. For silicon, there's 277, and so on down the sequence down here. And when you look at the bottom there, chlorine ion is only 130 parts per million. It's exceedingly scarce. Well, I thought, okay, it's a slight amount, but let's find out how much sodium chloride I can make by eroding the Precambrian crust. I assume that you had a thickness of 25 kilometers of continental rocks, calculated the volume and the mass that was there, used that value of 130 parts per million, and then calculated how much chlorine I can make out of that rock if I were to erode 25 kilometers of it. And this is a reasonable amount because we find parts of the granite crust that are eroded down on the basis of the mineralogy there at least 25 kilometers. When you do that, the amount that comes out is 3.5 × 10^20 grams of chlorine ions, but the amount of chlorine ions in the ocean is 2.67 × 10^22 grams of chlorine, and I couldn't produce enough. It was a total surprise to me. In fact, there's 19 times more of the amount of chlorine in oceans than I can possibly weather out of the granite, and it would take as much as I'd have to erode a thickness of 475 kilometers of the Earth's crust in order to produce the amount of chlorine in the oceans. Are you with me? All right, next. Well, we know from calculations that the total amount possible in the mantle of the Earth is 2.2 × 10^25 grams of chlorine. But we also find that there is chlorine coming out of volcanic eruptions. It comes out as a hydrogen chloride and acid that makes an acid rain that comes out. And if I take the average value of chlorine ions coming up from the mantle, coming out in volcanic eruptions per year, and divide it into the amount of chlorine that's in the oceans, then I can calculate how long it would take to make that amount. And it turns out to be 3.5 billion years to get all that chlorine out. All right? Well, that chlorine isn't totally coming out from that source because we have to take 1/19 of it because of the erosion there. And if I separate 1/19 of it, turns out I have to subtract about 0.8184 billion years from my original value of 3.5. And so we can produce the amount of chlorine in the ocean down to about a value of about 3.3 billion years it takes to get that in there. Next. But that doesn't account for all the salt, because on the continents we have rock salt deposits, every one of the continents, and so that rock salt also used to be in the ocean at one time, so we have to find out how long it would take to make that rock salt. But the continents cover about 66% are covered by sedimentary rocks. Of that 66%, 95 to 99% are shale, limestone, and sandstone. That leaves about 1 to 5% that consists of phosphorites, coal, banded iron, volcanic ash, chert, gypsum, and rock salt. Well, I can calculate the volume of sediments are there, take 1% of that to calculate how much volume there is of rock salt, and then in that mass of rock salt, I have a mass of chlorine ions, and then using the rate at which chlorine ions came out from the volcanoes, calculate how long it would take to make that amount of salt that's in rock salt. And it turns out I have to add another 0.3 billion years to my 3.3, and so it takes 3.6 billion years as an approximation of how long it takes to make all the chlorine in the oceans. All right, next. All right, the chlorine ion in comparison to the size of the silicon, the aluminum, magnesium ions, each of these types of atoms have a certain size. The silicon atom is the smallest in size. Oxygen down here is 1.4 angstroms in size. It's relatively large. If you would take grapefruit and put it in a crate, a certain size, if you pack them in there, between the grapefruit are certain sizes that you could pack something else in. All the crystals are formed from these 8 most abundant elements, and it depends upon their sizes how you can pack them together. If you'll find that all of these elements here will pack together pretty well with mostly oxygen as surrounding them. But look down here at chlorine. It's 1.8 angstrom in size. It's nearly twice the size of the sodium ion. It's so large that it doesn't fit into the crystal structure. You just can't pack it in there. It doesn't fit. All right, now if we look at the percentage of ions in the ocean, the chlorine ion, which is only 130 parts per million in comparison to sodium ion, which has 28,300 parts per million, you would think that this would have the most ions in the ocean. But note, the chlorine ion is nearly twice the amount of that of sodium. Okay? That seems Very strange, doesn't it? Next. The reason why is that the water in the ocean is what we call a polar molecule. That is, you all heard of H2O. That is, you have an oxygen atom here with two hydrogen atoms attached to it. And it turns out that the hydrogen is on one side of it. And the oxygen atom has a negative charge to it relative to the two hydrogens here, which have a positive charge. This side of the water molecule is polar. It's more positive on this side. And the other side is more negative. So you have a pole here. Okay? If that's the sodium, if this is the water molecule here, and I have a sodium ion up here, which has a positive charge, all the water molecules tend to surround the positive charge sodium ion so that the positive and the negative are attracted to each other. And the sodium dissolves in the water with all of these water molecules surrounding and orienting their poles that way. On the other hand, if this is a chlorine ion dissolved in the ocean, or in the water molecule being polar, the chlorine ion has a negative charge to it, so the water molecule orients itself so its positive charges are next to this negative chlorine ion. The difference is that the sodium ion over here is about half the radius of the chlorine ion. The chlorine ion then has a size about 3.5 times the size of the sodium ion. That means much more, 3.5 times as many water molecules will surround that chlorine ion as will surround the sodium ion. That makes the chlorine ion exceedingly soluble because the water then protects it from anything else. About the only way that you can get the chlorine to precipitate is to evaporate the water. It's very soluble. Okay, next. So the reason why we have chlorine ions that accumulate during more than 3.6 billion years is the very high solubility of the chlorine ions because the water molecule is polar. And the very large size of the chlorine ion prevents it from being incorporated into the minerals. It prevents it from being incorporated into animal parts or shells or whatever. It just doesn't fit in. So once it gets into the water, it stays there. It accumulates through time. Okay, some of the creationists say, well, that salt came up from water that came up out of the mantle. It isn't all by rain coming down during the flood. It also came up from the mantle. But if that were true, if sodium chloride came up from the mantle, it's so soluble as fast as it came up, it should be dispersed and dissolved. It isn't going to precipitate. So all these kinds of data indicate that the oceans must be much more than 7,000 years old and likely in excess of 3.6 billion years old. But let's go on to the next one. Here's a picture of my wife and myself at Salzburg, Germany. We went there as tourists. Salzburg, you can see they were mining salt there. There was a layer of salt about 500 feet thick. We were tourists and we went down into the mine. Well, surrounding this salt layer is a layer of shale, and all salt beds around the world have shale layers that are associated with it, which have mud cracks in them. Mud cracks tell me that we're in a desert climate where evaporation occurs. As evaporation occurs, the mud shrinks and develops cracks. You can't produce, that is, this is evidence that the salt that you find on the continents cannot be precipitated during a flood. It has to be deposited in the desert climate where things are drying out. Okay, next. All right. Next subject. I have to keep moving along. Now I'm going to take you to another subject that has to do with Noah's Ark. There's a man named David Fossil. He wrote a book in the late 1980s, and he was sure that he had found evidence of fossilized Noah's Ark. And it's not the usual shape of Noah's Ark, which is a barge shape, but more like the shapes of arks, or shapes of boats that the Egyptians built at that time, consisting of reeds. Only this time, the reed boat is 300 cubits long. This is typical of the Bible. That fits right in, 300 cubits. And he was sure that he's found this, and this is a possible example of where Noah's Ark was found in eastern Turkey. Let me show you where this is. There's Mount Ararat, There's the country of Turkey. It's right over here on the eastern border. Here's the boundary between Iran and Turkey. This area right in here is the mountains of Ararat. The structure that I'm talking about is right here, about 18 miles south of Mount Ararat. And right, it's situated in the midst of a large landslide, and it has the shape of a boat. Here's the landslide that you can see here coming down, and right there you can see the shape of the boat right there. That's a supposedly fossilized Noah's Ark. Next. This is David Fossil. He is a former merchant marine officer. He's familiar with boats. His mother was a member of a fundamentalist church who was sure that Noah's Ark was part of the history in which that occurred. And David was sure if he found fossilized Noah's Ark, it would be a nice feather in his cap. And because he found, with other people, found this particular structure that you can see right back there, then it would be very nice. And so he wrote this book, The Ark of Noah. All right, this is what it looks like in another scene. You can see people here for scale there. They have stretched out some yellow lines for helping to do their picking up of samples and analyzing it. And everybody here that was our creationists, they were sure that these structures that you see here that form the railing, other boulders in here are parts of the walls of the boat. And this is part of the gunnels, the deck, you name it. But after a while, David began to get suspicious of whether these people really knew what they were talking about. This is supposed to be fossilized wood. So he collected some 12 different samples in different places of this, which he was told that was petrified wood. He was not a trained geologist, and he smuggled them out of Turkey, and somehow he got a hold of me and said, is this fossilized wood? Okay. Next slide. Well, when I looked at it, not one of them was fossilized wood. This is a thin section of a volcanic rock. And these are plagioclase crystals in here, holes where glass, where the bubbles occurred. Those black areas are a mineral called magnetite, and the magnetite happens to be a titaniferous magnetite. Lots of titanium in it. Next. Well, at the same time that it was here, one of the people that came to this particular point was with him to look at that was another creationist, Dr. John Baumgartner. He's a world-famous geophysicist. He's mostly trained in physics. He doesn't know geology, really. And the two of them found a chunk of iron that looked like a piece of rusted bolt or part of a wall bracket that was, and Baumgartner assured David, this is absolute evidence that this is that this was a fossilized Noah's Ark because we've got evidence of iron bolts and brackets that are in here. He took half the sample and gave the other half to David Fossil. Next. And when Dr. Baumgartner took them out, he had it chemically analyzed. If that had been a rusty bolt, the iron content here should read 100%. It reads 76 to 89%. And it's got a lot of silica in it and a lot of aluminum in it, which goes into clay. It has a lot of calcium in it that goes into calcite, a fair amount of manganese and magnesium, but look at the titanium content there. Next slide. When I made a thin section of this supposed rusted bolt, you can see pieces of ilmenitic magnetite. It is titaniferous magnetite. It's got clay, it's got calcite, it's got quartz in it. This is not a piece of roasted iron. It's part of the volcanic rock that's formed there. Okay, next. There was another creationist there whose name is Ron Wyatt, also thought for sure that this was Noah's Ark and it was a fossilized remains of it. He is an archaeologist. He was not trained in geology, and he called up David Fossil one time. He said, I have found evidence of gunnels on the side of this ark. And David was so excited about this, he called up a TD team from Germany and a number of reporters. He paid all of their expenses to come to here so that they could photograph this. And after David and his team got there, he discovered that Ron Wyatt had carved the gunnels with some shovels. He had wasted all his money, and of course he lost, and Ron Wyatt lost all credibility with him. Okay, next. So really this is a natural geologic structure. It's what we call a doubly plunging syncline. It's just eroded down to have that shape, and it's perfectly natural in its form. Now I'm going to tell you about Dr. Ian Plimmer. I don't know whether it's Plimmer or Plimer. He's a professor of mining geology at the University of Adelaide, and he's published 120 refereed articles in 6 books. He's highly respected worldwide. He heard about this supposed Noah's Ark, and he came with David Fossil one summer, and his purpose was to collect the fossilized wood so that he could take that, analyze it to get a date on it from carbon-14 dating techniques so that he could show that it was 6,000 years old. Well, when he got there, he didn't find any fossilized wood. And the geologist that was there from Turkey that was a host with David Fossil, and he got this geologist aside and said, "What are you doing here? It's pretty obvious that this is not fossilized wood. Why are you calling it fossilized wood?" And this geologist explained to him, "Well, my department chairman is a Muslim. President of the university where I'm at is a Muslim. The president of Turkey is a Muslim. The Muslims have a story about an ark just like this in the Quran. They strongly believe that this is their ark. It has the same story of animals being brought there everywhere. It says we don't dare say that this isn't the ark on the basis that we will offend these people. So they made this into a national park. And what they do is they charge money to tourists to come there, and they use that money to pay for their research at the university. This is not very ethical, but this is what was going on." Next. All right. But there, if this isn't the ark, there are plenty of creationists that will tell you that the ark landed on Mount Ararat. Mount Ararat stands at 16,854 feet or whatever it is. If that were happened, then the water level here has to be over 17,000 feet so that the ark can land on top of here. It's hard for me to fathom that you can get water 17,000 feet thick over the whole world. Would you agree? But they're absolutely certain that Noah's ark is up here. I've had 6 different creationists contact me and send me pictures of what they have found that they are sure is Noah's ark. One of them is right here, up at that point. Next. And there it is. That's Noah's Ark sticking out of the ice that's present there. Next slide. If you're not certain, they have digitally enhanced that, and you can see the windows of the Ark, the door of the Ark right there, and you can see, my wife tells me, that's a camel poking his head out the window. None of these people have ever gotten a sample of fragments up there to bring it back to show that that's absolutely petrified wood. And for my purposes, all of these are parts of columnar joining, which is typical of volcanic igneous rocks, and it's really not Noah's Ark up there. Next. So none of them have brought back examples, as I say in this slide here, that this possibly could be Noah's Ark. Next. All right, in the Panamint Range here in California, we can find bristlecone pine tree. There's a live bristlecone pine in the background. Here is a dead one at this point here. Using dendrochronology, that is using tree rings, you can find out how long those trees lived. And you can develop a template of matching overlapping tree rings. And using dead ones plus live ones, you can make a template that shows that these bristlecone pines have been living there for 8,300 years. There's a gap in the record, and they can find some older dead trees in which are as much as 10,000 years old, which they can date with carbon-14 dating techniques. So those trees are older than the 7,000 years, but the creationist will tell you, well, that's okay. God created them that way. They can always do this by a miracle. But the scientific evidence is that it's much older. Okay, next. Well, did the flood really occur? And I'm going to tell you that the flood, a major flood, actually happened. And did it cover the entire earth? Here is the country of Iraq. This is where the Euphrates rivers come down. This is where the Tigris rivers come down to the Gulf of, I think it's Eden down here. All of this land in here, which stretches over 300 miles, is almost down to sea level. There are a few places in here where the hills stick up about 300 feet. If there had been a major typhoon in the past, in which high tide came in at the same time as the typhoon, and you had a tremendous amount of rain, water would be up in the high mountains and flood down through here. Water would come up here, and it would have covered all of this area. There are evidence in this area that the floodwaters were as much as 26 feet above the natural levees of these two rivers. If you have to realize that the curvature of the earth drops about 8 feet per mile. If you go 40 miles, that drops 320 feet. That's why you can't see, you see boats disappearing over the horizon because of the curvature of the earth. So if you just go as little as 40 miles here, any hills that stick up 300 feet, you can't see it. It's below the horizon. You follow me? So all of this area, which would have been their whole world, was covered with water. Okay. So the Bible has a huge boat, Noah's animals and flood. It turns out that the Quran, which the Muslims have a huge boat with animals and flood. There is the Babylonian epic of Gilgamesh, which represents an still older story in which there's a flood on the Euphrates River. There's a Babylonian epic of Atrahasis in which there's a flood on the Tigris River. And one of these, part of this story is that the gods there were going to destroy all of humanity. Does that sound familiar? And one of the chieftains that was in one of these villages along one of these areas, he got into the boat with his family, floated down the river to the mouth of the gulf there, and when things eventually subsided a bit, he got out on land and constructed an idol to worship the water god to make sure it didn't happen again. Okay, I guess the height above the sea level is 22 feet or above the water. But anyway, there is plenty of evidence that there was an ancient worldwide flood, and but you're not covering the whole earth, but what was to them was the whole world. If it really was a whole world evidence, as in for Noah, Noah should have gotten some pandas from China, some kangaroos from Australia, and some armadillos from Texas, brought them to the boat, and then after the boat settled, he's got to put all of these animals back there. It doesn't make good logical sense. Okay, now we're going to go to the fourth bit of evidence. I'm going to use the King James Version of the Bible, because that's what mostly the creationists have used. And these people say you must interpret the Bible literally, and they want to have it, the Bible, to be a perfect science text. And I want to point out to you that in the King James Version, there are 826 citations of heart in the Bible. There is zero citations of the brain. There's 360 citations of head and 96 citations of mind. But there's no reference to the brain at all. Okay. Now, where the Bible uses the word head, it's to represent part of the body that is either bowed, injured, or crowned. Or it's used to represent the leadership, such as the head of a household, a church, or the government. And the word head is never used as a place where emotions originate or thinking occur. Okay, next. The word mind is used in combination with the word heart as if these words represented the same place. And there's no indication that the author knew that the mind is in the brain. Here are some quotations for you, which is in mine heart and in my mind. 1 Samuel 2:35, perfect heart and with a willing mind, with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy strength, with all thy mind. Okay, next. There are eight, of those 826 citations, there are emotions associated with the heart, and you hear about lust, pride, adultery, love, mischief, and other examples. He will be glad in his heart, he will harden his heart. Hate thy brother within thine heart shall meditate terror. We normally associate all of these expressed emotions as coming from the mind, or as coming from the mind or brain, but not the heart. Okay. Next. And of these, okay.
Where we are?
I guess we're here.
Yeah.
So of these citations, we also find where the heart is used to think, to reason, to motivate, to doubt. That is perceiving the thoughts of their hearts and reasoning of their hearts. I applied my heart to know wisdom. Thus the heart is said to be the seat of life, the soul, the spirit, and understanding, and it's not the brain. Next. Okay, so there's an ancient understanding of the lack of the importance of the brain. The Egyptians at that time would make mummies. And in order to make the mummy, they helped to preserve it. One of the things they would do would be to take the heart out. And they would preserve that heart. And when they were done, they would put the heart back in. Okay? But they would take the skull, the head, and take some instruments and poke it through the nostrils, scrape out all the brains, and throw them away. Okay? Brains had no value. Just thought to be some kind of a filter. So it was in the ancient culture, the heart was thought to be the most important thing. It pulsed with life. It had blood running through the body. And so the early culture thought that this must be where life exists, and this is where all the thinking and emotions occurred. So there's zero citations of the brain in the Bible, and it confirms its unimportance. Now, if I were to say to my wife, I love you with all my brains, she wouldn't be very impressed. I use the cultural thing. I tell her I love her with all my heart. Okay? But this is not, as I would say, scientifically accurate. You also see heart symbols on cars. You see I heart Mary. You know what that means. It could just as equally mean I hate Mary. Okay? If you use all the interpretations of what heart is there. And we have Valentine cards with hearts. We have heart-shaped boxes of candy. So we all use the word heart with an interpretation of a site where love is. But if we were honest about how we interpret the Bible, we have to realize that it isn't just that. Okay? Okay. If the Bible is an accurate, inerrant science text, then I should say to the creationists, if you really believe that, then you should be sending people who have psychological problems to get their heart treated. Okay? Right? And this isn't what they're doing. Everybody with me? All right. They need to be consistent. Next. All right. I agree with Pope John Paul II, who said in 1996 that the Bible is not intended to be a science text, and that science is not in conflict with the biblical message. I think that we need not to ask the Bible what is true, but what is truth. Okay? This is what Alan Story told us last week. Not what is true, but what is truth. You need to do that for everything in the Bible in your interpretation. I don't read the Bible as a science text. And the creationists want to make this a perfect science text. All right. I also agree with Conrad Hayres. And Genesis chapter 1, he said it was not written as a listing of science events. Instead, the author was giving answers to local issues that faced the Hebrews at that time. And at that time, nearly all the tribes worshiped gods, such as the night god, the water, earth, animal, plant, star, moon, sun, and planet gods. And all of them were to be feared. And all of these gods were out to get them. Okay? And the author of Genesis says, well, I should point out to you that these gods also mated with each other. so that two of them would mate, have offsprings, and those two would mate and have offsprings, and so you would have complete generations of these gods. You also have the astrologers, which were the magi, and they followed the movements of the planets and the moon and the stars in astrology, so you have this to cope with at the same time. And the author of this Genesis story says this is not true. There's only one God. There's not many gods, and you don't need to be afraid of them. The one God created all of these objects. You don't have to make idols and worship them. Okay? So you have an entirely different interpretation. And at the end of Genesis 1, the summary sentences said, the above is what was created in 6 days. You would think that it would say, this is what was created in 6 days. Instead, what it says is, these are the generations of heaven and earth. And it was a pun. And all the listeners laughed out loud. Okay? Has nothing to do with that. So the purpose of Genesis, I think, was to answer a problem, a local problem at that time. It was never intended to be a science text. It was to answer a local problem. Okay, so the creationist model is that the Creator made the earth and life instantly by fiat less than 7,000 years ago, and that nothing that you can do, you can't do anything to that model in terms of, you just have to accept it by faith. You can't make any predictions out of it. On the other hand, the science model is that the Creator used natural laws, which the Creator also made these natural laws, and now you can make predictions with it. I can use myrmecite and polonium halos to indicate we have an open system. Then now I can use it also to look for ore bodies, possibly. And I can find where there are magmatic rocks and where there, that is, rocks formed from melts and not rocks which are formed by shearing and whatever, and use that knowledge in my geologic explorations, okay? And I can look at sequences of animals and plant fossils that indicate evolutionary trends that I can look for. And you can make new discoveries of older fossils based on what you see in these fossils as what you would predict they should look like. And you can use science, and that's what we do. And biological science uses all of the evolutionary concepts to produce their modern medicines and antibiotics. If these creationists were consistent, they should refuse to take antibiotics because science is evil, and you shouldn't do that, okay? But in science, we have a great Creator who makes things by very long periods of time, which are just as amazing as if you had created instantly. Okay, next. Now, I just summarize here. I think that the creationists will admit that the brain is where emotions and thinking occur, and not the heart. But this admission illustrates that they tend to choose data that fit their own model of inerrancy, and they ignore that which does not. If the Bible has some scientific errors in it, if interpreted literally, then the creationist should be willing to recognize that science also has much to offer in regard to the origin of the universe and the evolution of life, and both fields are not working against each other, but both reveal an awesome Creator. Next. All right. If you want more information and much more detail, then I have a website, and I put that up there for your reference. So all of this material is there, and you can utilize it. And I just repeat that I know lots of people that have contacted me, some of whom have been members of churches who are very intelligent people, and they say, I can't be a Christian because my church requires me to believe things that I don't believe. And I tell them, this is not necessary. The Bible was never intended to be a science textbook. What you need to do is ask the question, not what is true in the Bible, but what is truth. Okay? Then you have total freedom as a scientist to accept Jesus and to follow him, and that's what the purpose of the Bible is to tell you about a man who expresses love and care for people, and I'm willing to follow that guy. Okay, I'll stop there. Open it for comments and questions. Is that you?
Oh, you spoke earlier of radon. Halfway here in Washington State, the existence of radon is very, very minute.
Yeah.
Small areas east of Spokane in the Trent Birch Park and further north up in near Newport, Caldwell area, where radon does, leach to the surface, but not in quantities that would require mitigation, such as additional ventilation and structures. I share that with you. That's an area that generates a lot of fear and anxiety. And it's pretty much a phantom fear.
Okay, good. Glad you shared that. Anybody else?
Well, the new creation, this movement, is intelligent design now. Yeah. And so they're using biology for reversible complexity.
Intelligent design, again, chooses the data that they want to choose. And they are promoting essentially creationism. And there is not any real science. They only pick what fits their data and ignore that which does not. That's the problem.
No. Do you have any, you know, the waters above the waters below?
Sure.
Thanks. What's that?
If you use that and you put the waters above, mm-hmm. and somehow it's up there, the weight of that water pushing down on the atmosphere would compress it, heat it up, and if Noah were living in that condition, he would be cooked. We have in California what we call the hot winds,
Santa Ana's.
Okay, Santa Ana's, people think it's caused by hot desert winds. Okay, Santa Ana's result when there's a cold, dense hot part of air atmosphere over Canada and Alaska, which moves eastward through to Colorado, then it spills down from the high mountains down to Los Angeles. And as it spills down, it compresses and heats. If you take a tire and you pump up air in it, if you hold the hose, it gets very hot. Mm-hmm. It compresses. Well, this is what happens to air coming out and causes the Santa Ana winds. All of that water that's supposedly up high up there is going to put enormous pressure on people living on the earth. And when it comes down as rain, it releases heat, and that heat would have cooked them, all that water. So scientifically, it doesn't make any sense.
Did those people believe that at the time because they looked up and saw blue and that?
All right, people at that time thought that the heavens was a dome, a solid dome, and outside that, and nobody had any knowledge of galaxies beyond, all that they could see was the planets and the stars, which they thought were gods moving across the sky. You have to read the Bible in the context in which it was written, and the people who were trying to understand what was happening.
Larry, when the presentation stuff gets downloaded onto the net on Holden site, will your slides and that be there?
No, it will not, and we are testing it to see whether you can understand it without seeing the slides. However, I'm telling you that all of this information is at my website.
Oh, okay. So we have to take that.
So you can go there and you can see the article on the bogus art. You can see the article on water, the chlorine. All of that information is there.
And what is a chert?
What is chert? Chert is a form of silica, quartz. And there's a certain amount of dissolved silica that gets washed out by the streams out in the ocean. When it gets to the salt water, it tends to coagulate and condense into a very sticky material which settles to the ocean floor, forms nodules, which become chert. The Indians would take these nodules and break them and make arrowheads out of them because it was composed of quartz. Very hard. Okay. All right, I probably should read this website so that people that are listening to the recording can find out where it is. And my website is at www.csun.edu/tilde. It's on the upper left-hand corner of the computer, V vcgeo005/creation.html. I have, I think, something like 13 different articles there that are in opposition to creationism, and you can look it up if you want.
You know, I think it's good that that you challenge this, because it's a science is a little different than the Bible, because the Bible is not science. However, the Bible is what God has given us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to believe that God did create. How he created, you know, is a little different. You know, whether it's this, you know, whether it's 3.6 billion years or 10 billion years or even 7,000 years,
mm-hmm.
is not really the point. Not, you know, because the Bible, as you said, is about truth. You know, what does God really want to convey to us? It's really a spiritual book, in many ways, about what we should believe. I think it's important, therefore, to say that, you know, the Bible is the Word of God, and it is about truth, and it's about what God wants us to know. And I think sometimes when we get in discussions of whether, you know, there should be 7,000 years or the 4 billion years, it's more important to know that God did create it. And that's what's the key to who we are. And you don't lose sight and say, I'm a scientist, therefore I don't believe, you know, that God is an awesome God. I think, you know, that's the trap that you can get into, is say, well, therefore the Bible must be wrong, or isn't God's word, or whatever, but it really is God's word. And so I think we have to keep that in mind and keep that down. And I appreciate you making a statement about your faith, you know, both before and after, because I think that's important to understand that one can be a Christian and still be a scientist, and still, you know, see how God ordered things, which is absolutely awesome. As, you know, any doctor or you know, you look at your hand and it self fixes itself somehow. So, you know, this is just one microcosm of what, how God created what he created.
I can agree with you completely. God is the one, in my view, has created. Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I think the Father, Jesus, is perfectly honest and doesn't trick us. I don't think the Creator is out to trick us. He gives us information in a different way. He also created the laws. I've lost my train of thought of where I was going. I'll think of it in a moment.
How long did it take to create, or how long would it take for the mineral transfer for petrified wood to actually form?
For which?
How long would it take for petrified wood to actually
form? Okay, how long would it take petrified wood to form?
Yeah, from just...
Right, and this is an example of a chemical replacement. In order to make petrified wood, you have to bury the tree into an environment where bacteria and oxygen can't get to it. So it will sit there for a long time. And then you have to have the right conditions for the water to be basic in condition and not acidic in condition. Under those conditions, silica is soluble. And the silica moving in basic fluids, coming in contact with wood, which as it decays becomes organic acids. And so you get reaction between the bases and the acids, and you exchange a silicon atom for a carbon atom. It would be like having that wall over here composed of red bricks, and the mason comes along, oh, that brick looks like it needs to be replaced. He pulls out a red book and sticks in the yellow brick. Okay? And over here he pulls out a red brick and sticks in the yellow brick. And eventually all that wall becomes a yellow brick, and you change the wood, which is organic matter, into quartz, taking the same shape, but now looking like wood. And you ask, how long would it take? Well, I can't give you a straight answer. It might take a few years, and very quickly, if the fluids are coming through rapidly, it might take several hundred or 1,000 years. So I can't give you a straight answer on that. Okay? But it, in terms of geologic time, it doesn't take very long to change wood into petrified wood.
All the other conditions have, that you set up have to be just right.
So. That's right. And in terms of the fossil record, the problem there is, in order to make a fossil, you also have the right. And where are the missing links? Well, It takes the right conditions. You have to have a catastrophe that buries the animal. You have to have the right conditions to bring in mineral matter to replace whatever, the shells or whatever. Then you have to be able to erode things away to find it and to preserve it. And you might be missing all kinds of records that would give you the transitions. And we have that problem. Yes?
I thought the portion of the presentation about the chlorine atoms was particularly interesting. Is that was your own research?
It turns out to be my own research.
Has that been published?
It has been published, and where it's published is tells you, you can find out where it happens to be in the reports of the National Center for Science Education. And it might be in some libraries, but most people, most libraries don't have it. But it's published here, and you can get it at that point.
What year was that published?
Last year, maybe?
Okay.
I don't remember at this point. As far as I know, nobody else has ever considered this, and it's a kind of thing that I can't put in a scientific journal, and I can't publish in a religious journal because it's caught in between.
The other thing I wanted to ask is, you only briefly mentioned this in passing, but I've heard a lot. I have been to some young Earth creationist presentations before as well, so I'm fairly familiar with the Polonium rings theory. I thought this was pretty interesting, but a lot of times they talk about inaccuracy in carbon 14 dating, and you did mention it once in your presentation. Do you have anything, any remarks about accuracies or inaccuracies of carbon 14 dating?
Yes, there are places where you get inaccurate carbon 14 dating, and whenever that occurs, the analyzer has to look for what caused that. Sometimes it's scientific error, sometimes it's contamination. But when you take rings like the rings, tree rings, they can use those to establish, they can do carbon 14 dating on each of those rings and use those as a comparison to make sure you got something accurate. The problem is somebody will find some sandals somewhere of an ancient Indian. And if they don't know what they're doing, they bring it back, and somebody shellacks them to preserve it. As soon as they shellack it, they've ruined the dating technique. So, but at any rate, there are so many places, not only are carbon-14, but other means of using radioactive decay, that you can use three or four different methods to get the same date. And this is sort of rather convincing evidence that although these atoms behave chemically different from those, they still give the same date.
So correlation between different.
Correlation.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Are we supposed to stop? Thank you very much.
Thank you.